Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, in the background today, you can hear a recording that I made of a northern mockingbird in Las Vegas, so you might hear a jet and you might hear a dog in the background as well. I had a wonderful time in a remote hot springs in the desert down there with family for my son's birthday. And right now I'm getting ready for another trip in a different direction in just a few days. So this week and next, I will be running double features for our show. Our first feature today was released by Ken Lane, February 16th, 2024. It's titled Among the Stately Trees. And he has some suggestions as to how you know you are in the beautiful part of the desert, just in case you're wondering.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert here in the beautiful high desert. Red, blue, black, silver, making sweet sounds on the radio, and another storm on the way. Sometimes people come out here and look around at the substandard housing and the miles of vacant retail buildings and the enormous, hideous Walmart and the inexplicable number of cars. A lot of cars from Arizona and Texas pumping out great clouds of noxious smoke, while puttering down the fast lane at 25 miles per hour. And the people say, what's so beautiful about that? And I say, well, nothing. Nothing at all. It's hideous. It's an outrage. It's gruesome. And then, as I'm walking away, almost running, really, sometimes they catch up and ask, so where's the beautiful part? Where is the beautiful part, anyway? Well, you can start by walking about a mile past the last parking lot or dirt road or residential car parts dump or informal halfway house or accidental pit bull breeding farm, and keep going in the direction of the difficult terrain. The hills and the mountains and the great boulders, not the hills covered in radio transmission towers, radio relay towers, lead me to my baby. Head toward the ones with nothing up there at all, nothing made by the hands of men. Nothing up there but more boulders, more spiky yucca trees that slash your arms. Junipers and Joshua trees up to the craggy peak where the stately pinyons stand proud. Keep going that way. When you can no longer hear the roar of the highway, the constant sirens, the big rigs rumbling down the hairpin curves at 65 miles per hour, the approximately 25,000 constantly barking dogs in every small town, etc. Then go another mile or so. Get a mountain between you and it. The thing, the horror, the vast wasteland of cracked stucco and plastic letters and the medicated masses slouched before the video screen. The only God they know. And that God is an evil God, a thing of malice. It speaks lies through the universal global telecommunications consciousness, and it is insane. A jabbering cacophony, an electronic nerve agent where the only topics are shopping, slaughter, and more shopping. And did you see this year's exciting new advertisements? Right, you just escaped all that. Now you might even be able to hear yourself think. Or better yet, hear yourself not think. Because your attention has been charmed away by the chirping birds, the gamble's quail muttering as they scurry up the dry wash. The late winter breeze whispering through the creosote branches and desert willows, even the sand is beautiful. The decomposed granite sand with flecks of quartz and gold catching the sunbeams before you. Keep going. Until the sun sets and the ravens are gathering everybody for the sundown social and the coyotes are howling and gusty winds are coming up the slope. Notice how you feel. How alive. High desert is an up-close feast for the senses. You can smell the sage and the juniper. Hear the rock crunching beneath your feet. Taste the stick of Mormon tea hanging out of your mouth like a fancy cigarette. And when the weather is cool, as it often is this time of year, the warmth of the sun is welcome, appreciated. You bask in it like a lizard on a rock. But eventually, you've gotta come down the mountain, apparently, back to the real world, as they say, meaning back to the entirely artificial world of unnecessary electronic commerce and annoyances that monitor your every move, your every habit, your every behavior. Also, Jeff Bezos can earn another $8 million per hour. Back to late notices and updates to your customer experience. Back to the six empty houses around you. Because the pandemic real estate boom, fueled by low-interest speculator money and short-term holiday rentals, has bottomed out. And now it turns out all your neighbors moved to Arizona for nothing. Or maybe they like Drought Valley Estates, just fine. I mean, they can reach out the window of their already falling apart 2018 model home and borrow the toothpaste from the neighbor's bathroom. Washed out, cracked stucco beige outside, washed out gray and off-white everything inside. You can quit worrying about going to church because, buddy, you're in hell already. But you're building equity. Maybe. Back in 2018, somehow a half dozen years ago, I did a show at the Palm Springs Art Museum, a live episode, and because there was an Andy Warhol exhibit that had just opened, I dug up some stories about Warhol in the West. Especially the making of the extremely vulgar and ridiculous and more entertaining than you'd expect Lonesome Cowboys at an old Western movie ranch outside of Tucson. A lot of the Warhol prints on display were from his Endangered Species series. In the 1980s, Warhol loved nature and solitude in moderation. He owned land outside Aspen, Colorado that he apparently only used for such purposes when he was around. And he owned the beautiful old compound at the tip of Long Island, 20 acres of the rare Montauk Moorlands. A rustic 1930s fishing camp settlement on the seashore, surrounded by protected wetlands and cliffs and open space. The Rolling Stones called it Memory Motel on the song of that same name. It's a raw landscape up there on the tip of Long Island with 30-foot bluffs and a rocky shoreline below, trees gnarled by the wind. A place that has often been described as extreme and a draw for, quote, the souls of artists, writers, and musicians who seek the edge. Can you tell that quote came from a New York Times feature? This wild seashore was Andy Warhol's favorite place, and he kept it like it was. This is what he said about it. Quote, I think having land and not ruining it is the most beautiful art that anybody could ever want to own. He said nearly the same thing to an Aspen Times reporter in 1981. Land is the best art. And that really stuck with me, what Warhol said about the greatest art. Having ownership of wild land and not doing anything to it. Leave it like it was. Keep it like it is. Andy Warhol was deeply religious, a Byzantine Catholic, like generations of his Ruthenian Slovak ancestors before him. And he looked at the wonders and beauty of creation that he was blessed enough to have stewardship over, and he kept it like it was.
Desert Oracle Radio.
If you're interested in what's going on with your public lands in the desert, especially the Mojave and the Great Basin, but really all of them, which include the mountains, then make sure you follow Patrick Donnelly from the Center for Biological Diversity. His social media accounts on the usual bad, but that's all we got channels, and especially his email newsletter, Sage and Sand. I'll link to both of those on the Desert Oracle radio blog, because we never stopped blogging at Desert Oracle. It was from Patrick Donnelly that I learned about this dingbat outrage from the Lincoln County, Nevada commissioner. What's this guy's name? Vermin Bigley? No. Varlin Higley. The guy who hates pinyon and juniper woodlands. And is apparently the local stooge for the nation of Denmark and some shady shell company wanting to destroy these wild high desert and mountain woodlands and turn the resulting mush into biofuel to send to Denmark. Which really sounds like the kind of palm oil clear cutting that America usually does to poorer nations. Patrick Donnelly, welcome to Desert Oracle Radio. Please tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ken, and I'm glad you're shining a light on this issue. You know, across the deserts, but especially the Great Basin Desert, cutting down pinyon juniper woodlands has been kind of a staple of land management for many decades, if not centuries. There's really been a war on pinyon juniper woodlands. And, you know, it dates back to the colonization of the West by Europeans, and they wanted to maximize the amount of forage available for their cattle. And so it turned out that cutting down all those trees would then create more grass and feed for cattle. And so there's really been this long-term project of exterminating pinyon juniper woodlands across the Great Basin. But there's always been this question of, well, what do you do with the slash that's left over? And sometimes they leave it in place. Sometimes they masticate it, you know, with these huge masticators that turns it into mulch, basically. But there's certainly never been an economic benefit to it until now. Some starry-eyed dreamers there in Lincoln County think they've stumbled upon a economic benefit for the pinyon juniper trees that they want to cut down in the form of biofuels, and converting these rich Great Basin forests into biofuels for container ships out of the Port of Long Beach. As I said, there's always been people cutting down pinyon and juniper, and you know, my organization of others have been raising the alarm about that and fighting that for many years. But I think this is an extremely concerning development, because now there could be an economic imperative for more pinyon juniper deforestation. And so perhaps earlier the impetus was to create more forage for cows or to create fuel breaks or other justifications that agencies give. But now there may be this, hey, we're going to beat climate change by cutting down all the pinyon and juniper forests, this new impetus for doing so. And so this is a really concerning development that we are pushing back on.
That is incredible. And that LA Times story from 5-6 days ago, I'll link it up, was good for getting the news on the national or Western national radar, I guess. But I also thought it was kind of insane. You know, the headline, let's see here. Love them or loathe them, pinyon juniper woodlands are a growing biofuel battleground. What the hell is that? We're doing both sides now on hating forested mountains and high desert wilderness and public land?
That's a good observation, because that really is part of the dialogue here. It's not just, oh, we need to cut down some pinyon juniper to create feed for cattle. Like, there is a vilification of pinyon and juniper. They even have the completely scientifically incorrect thing of calling them invasive, like invasive pinyon and juniper are taking over our sagebrush steppe. And A, it's just not true, but B, it really does involve this kind of vilification of the pinyon and juniper trees, that they're this negative influence taking over and must be beaten back. You know, there's almost a moral element to it.
And that's bizarre. I mean, that's the iconic American landscape. That's the Western Vista vision of John Ford and Clint Eastwood. That's what most of Angeles National Forest is. Beloved and needed by millions. That's what the mountains look like here in Joshua Tree. The Mojave National Preserve and the Desert National Wildlife Refuge. The latter of which is in Lincoln County, Nevada, right? Part of it.
Yes, this is to the east of there. This the area where this project is proposed. But yeah, Lincoln County has a huge amount of pinyon juniper woodlands all across the county. Really, all of eastern Nevada is kind of a pinyon juniper empire. And of course, that's the epicenter of pinyon juniper removal. The classic technique for killing pinyon juniper forests is with a technique called chaining, where two bulldozers will drag between them an anchor chain, like a heavy ship anchor chain, drag between two bulldozers, uprooting pinyon and juniper trees as they go. This technique is really horrifying to see it in action. But the chain is actually called the Ely chain, because, you know, this technique was invented there in Ely, Nevada.
And so, oh, Lord.
There's a long history of these folks, you know, killing off pinyon juniper woodlands and taking great pride in it.
And when you are, not you, but when people are dragging massive ship chains and uprooting and destroying the forest, it's also all the wildlife there as well, right? The badgers that are burrowed there, the bobcats. What else is up there?
Well, sure. I mean, pinyon juniper woodlands are the kind of mid-elevation ecosystem of the Great Basin. And so, you know, if you're above 5,000-6,000 feet, you're probably going to be in some pinyon and juniper for up till, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 feet. And so lots of wildlife rely on pinyon juniper woodlands. It's been estimated there's 150 vertebrate species and 450 plant species that occupy pinyon juniper woodlands. And so that's going to include stuff like we all love, elk and deer, you know, yeah, badgers for sure. But also, you know, rare plants, shrubs, kind of the whole panoply of desert wildlife and desert plants, you know, thrive within a pinyon juniper woodland.
The Desert Oracle book has a big chapter in the middle that's set in the pinyon juniper wildlands of Lincoln County, specifically the Mount Irish Wilderness, one of my favorite places anywhere. And in the book, that's where I'm out hunting petroglyphs of the mysterious Piranagat Man with George Knapp and Matt Adams from KLAS-TV in Las Vegas. Highway 93, east from Crystal Springs. I know a lot of our listeners have been out there. That's one of the most beautiful drives in America. You know, I always take the long way going into Utah. And you and I have talked before about the Desert National Wildlife Refuge. So this is very much in our program's range of interest. And one of the things that kind of stuns me with this scheme is it's called a benefit for the carbon situation. Isn't the best carbon storage the absolutely free and natural carbon storage of our forests and woodlands?
Boy, that does make a lot of sense, doesn't it? Forests are carbon sequestration powerhouses. We've been making that argument. You know, I think they're playing a little shell game with carbon here, where you cut down forest, you claim it's biofuels, and you swap it out for petroleum products being used by the container ships. And so you can say you're saving the climate. And as long as you ignore the fact that you're destroying a native forest, then that, you know, comes out looking good on the balance sheet. And again, I think it gets back to this, not only are pinyon and juniper trees vilified, but their identity as a forest is denied. Like, they are not recognized as a forest.
That's, you know, insane. The people who,
it is. It's crazy. And especially, like, for us in the desert, I mean, the pinyon juniper woodland, that's our forest.
That's our forest. Yeah.
Right. And yet the people who put forward these projects deny that it's a forest. They claim it has low biodiversity. They claim it's just these encroaching shrub-like trees, you know, and kind of denigrate its value. And so, yeah, it's easy then. You just, you know, plow it all up and turn it into container ship fuel, and nothing's lost in that kind of calculus, which really ignores the incredible value that these systems have, not just for biodiversity, but also for climate.
And this is also the landscape that certainly one of our favorite books, Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey, takes place in.
Yeah, and I've been talking a lot about pinyon juniper removal in the Great Basin, but it's also a project that's been embarked upon extensively on the Colorado Plateau in Utah, very extensively. So certainly Abbey's country is not immune from the effects of chaining and deforestation.
So the ancient juniper that he wants to write a whole book about can end up in the tank of a ship that's taken dildos from China to Los Angeles, I guess.
Almost poetic, isn't it?
This is also the backyard of Las Vegas. Millions of people. It's an absolute wonderland of quiet, majestic wilderness that's, what, 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours from the suburbs. And I've always figured you got to use it or lose it with public lands. What's a good way for people who already love the basin and range environment to get to know this area that this foreign project wants to destroy?
Well, that is one of the great ironies here. Lincoln County has been billing itself as an outdoor tourism destination. Certainly, you know, with Basin and Range National Monument there and the Mount Irish petroglyph area, like you described, but also like they've developed mountain biking trails in the area of Caliente, which is the city, the small town where this project would be located. So it's sort of ironic that they're developing mountain biking trails that are going to go through a deforested wasteland. It seems kind of counterintuitive. But yeah, going out to Caliente is, you know, it's a great place to visit public lands. Like I said, there's mountain biking trails, great hiking, a lot of historic mining artifacts and old mines to poke around in. And it's a beautiful place to explore public lands. And it's a little higher elevation, so you can do it. It's a little cooler in the warmer months.
Yeah, you can go up there when it's 115 on the strip and find a nice place to do dispersed camping. I've certainly done that in summertime. And I've used the Lincoln County Tourism website for many years to find interesting places to poke around up there from the Paranagat Valley on up. And I'm wondering what those people that you mentioned, the people who are promoting Lincoln County as an outdoor destination for people in Vegas and beyond, what do they think about clear-cutting mountainsides for some dicey European ethanol factory?
Well, you know, this is still just a proposal. They basically have an MOU with the Danish government, but they certainly don't have permits to cut down all those trees. There's whole permitting processes that they're going to have to go through with the Bureau of Land Management before they can start clear-cutting forests for container ship fuel. And so there will be public participation opportunities during those permitting processes where, you know, certainly local people, but also people who care about the desert, like your listeners, will be able to weigh in as to whether or not this is a good use of our public lands and our public forests. So, you know, stay tuned for that. But this is still just an idea in the economic development officer's eye and not necessarily something that's going to be executed very soon.
Well, that's a relief a little bit. And you will tell us, as hopefully it doesn't progress at all, but if it does progress, you'll tell us who to bug about it and what lawsuits the Center for Biological Diversity is filing when, if, hopefully not when, it gets to that point.
Yeah, we will keep the world posted about that. This is certainly something we are glad is capturing the attention of people. You know, we already have some litigation going against a Pinyon Juniper deforestation project not far up the road from Lincoln County in White Pine County in Spring Valley. And so we have litigation against one of those projects there. It's not affiliated with this biofuels debacle, but, you know, we are in court trying to stop clear cutting of Pinyon Juniper forests. And it's really a top priority for our organization.
Patrick Donnelly, Great Basin Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. It's always good to talk with you. And thanks for doing this work for the Wild Southwest.
Yeah, glad to be here with you. Thanks.
And that's Desert Oracle Radio for tonight. Thank you for listening. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Our second episode today was also released by Ken Lane on February 16th, 2024, and this one is called The Ballad of Mojo Nixon. Are you familiar with that name?
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. A couple days ago, my old friend and mentor, Mojo Nixon, passed away in what you could call a monumental fashion. He played a final rock and roll show with his most dedicated fans dancing and hollering in the audience. Then he closed down the bar, surrounded by the outlaw country musicians he loved and nurtured for 20 years as afternoon DJ and master of ceremonies on the satellite radio station he brought to life with Little Steven from the E Street Band, Sirius XM's Outlaw Country. Now, I wasn't there, so this is all hearsay, including this part, which I got on good authority from somebody who was there. Mojo Nixon, who had played thousands of shows over four decades, was having rock and roll breakfast this past Wednesday with a number of musicians, including the great Warner Hodges, the whirling dervish guitar slinger from the Nashville Scorchers. Mojo says to Warner that the set he'd played the night previous was, quote, the best of my whole life. And that if he died right then and there, he'd die happy. Mojo Nixon died in his sleep shortly thereafter. His big old heart just stopped beating. We can hope it was painless, just drifting off into the satisfied sleep of a lifelong performer, a lifelong preacher and troubadour who knocked out the crowd once again and loved every minute of it. Born Neil Kirby McMillan Jr. 66 and a half years ago in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, young Mojo grew up in Danville, Virginia, steeped in the bloody history and weird old American culture there on the Dan River, just over the North Carolina state line. You've heard about the wreck of the old 97. That happened in Danville in September of 1903. By the 1960s, Danville was boiling over with civil rights protest. After a century of pent-up frustration in the long-suffering black community. Young Kirby McMillan never forgot when Martin Luther King Jr. came to town, railing against the white cops' vicious beatings of the mostly black protesters. Kirby's dad owned the soul music station in Danville, which meant nonstop black music from the mountaintop of that American art form. It was Arthur Conley's hit Sweet Soul Music that Mojo says grabbed him young and never let go. Do you like good music? That sweet soul music. Arthur Conley spends the rest of the song hyping the great musicians who created the form: Lou Rawls, Sam and Dave, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, and James Brown. Kirby McMillan liked good music and wandered for years playing in various bands, moving to London to try to join the Clash, as he often claimed, or moving to the Rocky Mountains of Colorado because that's where Hunter Thompson could be found. And then Kirby washed up in the unremarkable Navy town of San Diego, which is how I came to know him, right about the time he adopted the persona of the Right Reverend Mojo Nixon, a one-man band, a mushroom maniac howling at the moon, bashing out a Bo Diddley beat with a battered Sparklets water bottle down by the power lines.
I'm cruising out past the interstate, out past the fire roads, back behind the dynamo, out past Route 1, 4.
All of this because he'd been passed over when Country Dick Montana put together the Beet Farmers. The cowpunk band so good that the LA Times rock critic Robert Hilburn called them the best American band to come down the pike since Creedence Clearwater Revival. That was the crisis that created Mojo Nixon. This is American musical history, little known today. But for a few short years in the biker bars and cowboy beer halls on the hillbilly outskirts of San Diego, the Beet Farmers and Mojo Nixon and a handful of other roots rock groups, mostly forgotten today, including my own four-piece, the Outriders, who put out one vinyl LP ourselves once our record company in Austin crumbled, like so many indie labels. Well, we all had a joyous music scene as lively as anywhere in America at the time, including Athens, Georgia, Tucson, Arizona, even Los Angeles. I know some of you living out in the desert today witnessed it all, and even remember some of it. I was having trouble keeping guitar players in my own band, and I just agreed to open a half dozen Beet Farmers weekend shows at Bodie's when I lost yet another guitarist. Country Dick had already made his hand-illustrated flyers for the month ahead and wasn't going to stand for any backing out. So he must have talked to Mojo, because Mojo calls me.
Country Dick says I gotta play guitar in Kenny Lane's band.
He called you whatever made you sound the most Southern. And if your name didn't work as a Southern name, he'd make up a terrible nickname like Gopher Killer or Bullethead. So I got off pretty easy. I gave him the address for the air conditioning shop where we practiced, and he fleshed out our meager set list by singing Chuck Berry's The Promised Land, the Elvis Presley version, obviously, and by doing a mini solo set with his guitar and his 5-gallon Sparklets bottle. We did a live radio broadcast out of some retro car hop burger place in Santee, which might have been the first time the Reverend Mojo Nixon was on the radio airwaves. Did I mention that Mojo Nixon got us our record deal? That was when he spent a week in Austin, which would become a second home for him, especially at the Continental Club. But towards the end of 1985, he came back from Texas with some news for me. He says, Kenny Dean Lane, you know about the Tailgaters? I told him that I did. The Tailgaters were this swamp rock trio out of Texas led by Don Leedy, who's still gigging around Austin, by the way. Well, Mojo had met up with the guy who ran the Tailgaters label. Ran it into the ground. But the guy liked our demo tape, 8 songs we put down on a reel-to-reel in our rehearsal space, my dad's air conditioning shop. And after about a year of waiting around, I got the dot matrix printout of the contract. I had my girlfriend's law school professor dad read it over, and that's how Mojo got us a record contract. The actual record never came out, although the label did pay for Dusty Wakeman to mix the lackluster studio recording. At Mad Dog Studios, that was Dusty's place, which was out in El Segundo or Torrance at the time, long before he moved to the Mojave. There's a story for another time about how we had to go up to Hollywood, my friend and drummer Sam Chamis and myself, and threaten to throw the record label owner out of his 4th-floor office over Hollywood Boulevard. Because, of course, the guy had abandoned Austin for L.A. and was now sitting behind his secondhand desk, quaking in his shiny Melrose Avenue cowboy boots. Because I was ready, willing, and able to dangle him out the window until we got our master recordings back. When we got the tapes, got his very shaky signature on the release letter I had folded in my pocket, it did not take long at all. We put out the record ourselves, got the indie distributor Jem, J-E-M, to put it out, got Dave Alvin's Song Publishing Company to do our publishing, got some left of the Dial airplay, managed to make the College Music Journal charts here and there. But it never really took off. That scene was already in the rearview mirror. Not least because I was already over it. Songs I'd written when I was 17, recordings that were 2 or 3 years old. And despite the fact that we were still playing to a loyal crowd in our little town, the train had left the station. The Beat Farmers were long gone, touring forever. Lost an original member with the departure of my friend Buddy Blue. Mojo was off making a Jerry Lee Lewis biopic in Memphis with Dennis Quaid and Winona Ryder and John Doe from X. And I had just spent a glorious day with Hunter S. Thompson and decided then and there to retire from a music career that was stuck in the mud. I just remembered something. The night after hanging around with Hunter Thompson at the Radisson Hotel in Mission Valley, I opened for Jason and the Scorchers at the same club where my band opened for Chris Hillman and the Desert Rose Band, Del Fuego's, all these traveling Americana acts. Stuck in the local opener slot. Time to put it to rest, die with dignity. Half a year later, I was traveling around myself, alone, writing long articles for a glossy culture magazine nobody'd ever heard of. But they paid me, and they paid my travel expenses. Sometimes. By the time grunge hit, I was living in Prague, writing for the expat newspaper and doing an afternoon show on Radio Jedna. I'd sort of go back and forth between journalism and book writing and radio and music for the rest of my life, apparently. People with better songs survived Wrestler Records. I mean, Lucinda Williams. But it was another year or so before she found another label, Rough Trade, which put it out in 1988, Dusty Wakeman produced. Widely acclaimed with classic American songs like Passionate Kisses and Change the Locks. I changed the name of this town. Her ultimate moment was sort of delayed until 1998-99. When she put out her masterpiece, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, and became one of the all-time great singer-songwriters. Lucinda was on that Outlaw Country cruise last week, too. The one where Mojo played his last rock and roll show. Steve Earle, who co-produced, or pre-produced, Car Wheels, was on the Hillbilly Cruise boat as well. I heard Steve Earle's goodbye to Mojo message on the satellite radio the day after I heard the news. And that's when I pulled over and finally cried.
Friends of the revolution, I am the Right Reverend Mojo Nixon from the Screaming Church of the Epileptic Jesus. That's right, I'm here at Jesus Motors. We want to save your money. We want to save your soul right here at J Motors. That's right. Walk this way, brothers and sisters. Picture your family in this fine automobile. Picture them. Yes, pay your family in this fine automobile. It's not a satanic automobile. No, 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 no. It's a Christian automobile. No car on the lot's more than $666 right here at Jesus Motors. So come on down. Bring the family. Bring the dog. dogs to Jesus Motors. We're going to save you money. We're going to save your soul. We're going to see you right here.
Jesus Motors, 227 Salvation Pike, Cashflow, Kentucky, 0492.
Every magical, musical scene is short-lived by necessity. It can only burn hot and bright like Jack Kerouac's Roman candle romantic heroes. The Beat Farmers and Mojo Nixon were the two acts that caught a train to the promised land. They put out records, toured America, got some notoriety. Mojo even got on MTV, a regular presence on music television for a couple years. And his lunatic rants against MTV is what did it. He debated Pat Buchanan on CNN, got married at a go-kart track. And after four albums with his washboard-playing sidekick, Skid Roper, Mojo made his great Memphis rock and soul record, Otis. Produced by Jim Dickinson and featuring John Doe on the bass, Country Dick Montana on drums, and in true indie record company tradition, his label Enigma fell apart just as the album was getting out to the world. But having grown up in a radio family and having a persona that worked as well from a DJ booth as live on stage, Mojo became a disc jockey, his own weird twist on the FM shock jock. He retired from music, but always came back like he did for 8 years of outlaw country cruise ship bacchanals. Like the one he played on February 6, 2024, when he was still with us. I never knew anybody who was such a fanatic for the music he loved. Soul music especially, but also honky-tonk country, punk rock, folk singers like Phil Oakes, all kinds of rock and roll. Mojo loved Bruce Springsteen. We all did back then. Early on, Mojo and I noticed we both wore what he called Bruce boots. Those snub-nosed black leather biker boots with the steel rings at the heel straps. We both wore those short-sleeved gas station attendant shirts, too. His from the thrift store, mine from my day job, working all day at my daddy's garage, as Springsteen sang. Oh, we loved Darkness on the Edge of Town, and especially Nebraska, which had come out a year or two prior. We all did songs off Nebraska. Mojo did the B-side to Atlantic City. It was called The Big Payback, but working, working, working for The Big Payback, made for Mojo. The Beat Farmers did Reason to Believe, put it on their first album on Rhino. I was kind of moody then and now, so I did State Trooper with the band. Real slow and menacing. We drove up to the old L.A. Sports Arena to see the E Street Band on Halloween night, first leg of the Born in the USA tour. Folding chairs on the concrete floor. Bruce played for 3 hours and then did an encore of Halloween novelty songs. Mojo about lost his mind. He was either standing on that chair hollering or jumping straight up and down like he had a pogo stick. This was something I witnessed again and again. Once we drove up to the Palladium in Hollywood to see a couple of Southern bands, more punk, then cowpunk, whatever that was, Jason and the Scorchers and the Georgia Satellites. Their legend was already spreading from the underground. They played locomotive live shows, both bands. By that time, I was bouncing up and down all night, too, with Mojo and my friend and drummer Sam right up against the stage. Mojo cut people loose. He freed you from the ties that bind. It was a dance floor show, so we were all smashed together, half drunk off parking lot cocktails of gin and Mountain Dew. Going wild. I've often remembered that show as one of the best I've seen and heard. Just an explosion of energy and beautiful sound. But maybe 5 years ago, I'm driving around the desert with the Outlaw Country station on, Mojo's Loon in the Afternoon weekday DJ slot, and he's got a couple of those guys in the studio, Jason and Warren from the original Nashville Scorchers. Mojo tells the story of going to that show at the Palladium circa 1985, how it changed his life. The greatest rock and roll concert of the decade, etc. Now, I hadn't talked to him in a couple of years at that point. The last time I talked to him, in fact, was on his politics talk show on Sirius XM. Around 2012 or so, when I was doing political whatever. But at that moment, I was just listening in on Mojo and a band we saw together and those nights of low-budget glory. I've had 5 defining influences in my life, on my life. I was lucky enough to have memorable meetings with 2 of them, Edward Abbey and the aforementioned Hunter Thompson. And even luckier to spend my formative years in the company of the other 3. Country Dick and Buddy Blue from the Beet Farmers. And good old Mojo, the last of the 5 to depart our world. I guess that's why this one hit so hard. The years just keep rolling by, and it has been many long decades since I was a kid who needed to know everything immediately to do it all while there was time. That's a hell of a thing to lose when you're getting older, when it's absolutely crucial to do whatever else you're going to do. How do you not feel the devil's hot breath on your neck, seeing somebody as vital and alive as Mojo go down at 66 and apparently on top of the game? And I don't even believe in the devil, but I believe in death, who is coming for me and for everybody else. Sooner or later, and it's leaning towards sooner. So tonight I want to remember how blessed I was to come under the influence of these towering figures. Everybody wanted to hang around those guys, to bask in their glory. And for whatever reasons, a quiet kid of 17 was accepted into their inner circle. I slept on their floors, lost my money in Country Dick's poker games, was seduced by their ex and occasionally current girlfriends, did their drugs, drank their liquor, and borrowed their records and books like it was my own personal Beat Poetry Library of Congress. That's why I never regretted skipping college. I was part of the Beet Farmers graduate program in Weird Old American Studies. Besides, I got to DJ on the college radio station and write for the Daily Aztec at SDSU just up the road from Bodie's. The redneck biker bar next to Alberto's Taco Shop. For real money, my band would play frat parties where you were paid in both cash and cocaine by boys in pop collars and Ray-Bans who would shortly become the accounting firm vice presidents of the world. People who, in Mojo's eyes, got no Elvis in them. Well, that's how I'll end this tale. And I appreciate you indulging me tonight as I remember somebody who made a lasting impact on what's left of American culture. And who did it during the pastel and perm and plastic 1980s, looking out at the fake Cosby Show world of the Reagan decade. Mojo could see that a little bit of Elvis Presley was still out there, whether in punk rock or the TV evangelists or the flashy redneck NASCAR racers he loved. For Mojo's third record, he organized a couple cars full of San Diego music people to drive up to the studio in LA, where he conducted the album's background vocals on 6 or 7 tracks. And that's how I was part of music history on that day, as one of the Dinkleberry singers drunkenly hollering on Elvis is Everywhere. They even put my name on the record, along with everybody else crowded into the studio on that delightful day. So call some people over, pick up some barbecue and beer, and put on a Mojo Nixon record. And if you haven't talked to somebody in a long time, somebody who played such an outsized role in your life, why not give them a call tonight? Let them know while they're still around. Good night from the voice of the desert.
That's right. You got that Elvis inside of you and he's talking to you. He says he wants you to sing. Everybody got to sing like the king. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Like the king. Uh-huh. Get that leg going now. Uh-huh. And get your lip too. Uh-huh. Not no fool Billy Idol lip either. Uh-huh. Everybody. Uh-huh. Yeah, we're rocking now. Uh-huh. Elvis is with us. He's uh-huh. with us and he's speaking to us. He says, peoples, uh-huh. he says, peoples, uh-huh. everybody, everybody gotta sing.
Elvis is everywhere. Elvis is everywhere.
My thanks to Ken Lane for his work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening. Please call and leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 1-406-404-6246. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. Till next week, stay well and sweet dreams.